My name's Emily Oster. I am an economist. I work at Brown University.
Cool. And let me ask you this easy question. We'll start. Why do people have kids, Emily? I mean, biological imperative apart, unless it's all the biological imperative.
I think this is probably an open question for debate. I think many people would tell you that it's the biological imperative. I think that some people would tell you, you know, kids are enjoyable. I think that some people would tell you, particularly in developing countries, people have kids as an investment in their old age, or even, you know, to work on their farms when the kids are young. So I think those are probably the leading candidate explanations.
Okay, and those are all good and believable in theory. Do we have any data that suggests that we actually know anything about this question, or not really?
We have some data, and I think that probably you'd see all of those things show up as explanations. I mean, we certainly see people having remittances from their kids and telling us that, you know, remittances from their kids are an important reason to have children. And certainly, you know, many people will tell you, I enjoy having my kids, maybe not at every single moment, but that broadly I like them, and that was a reason to do it. But I think it's hard to separate the biological imperative because, of course, your biology is telling you that that's something you want to do. And once you've done it, you hardly want to say, actually,
It was all biology.
It was all biology. And, you know.
Yeah.
Exactly.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
We're talking today about fertility and then mortality. And then how fertility is affected by mortality. We might even get to overpopulation. The economist Emily Oster has done a lot of research on fertility. She's also the author of a book called Expecting Better: Why Conventional Pregnancy Wisdom is Wrong and What You Really Need to Know. Let me ask you this. When you bring up, you know, the different economic parts of the reason why people have kids, or maybe explain after the fact why they've had kids, what do we know generally about the factors that make a given person or family more or less likely to have kids? Let's say socioeconomic status, maybe the political environment in the place you live, personal philosophy or religion, access to technology. I mean, those are just a few of the ones we can think of.
Yeah, I think many of those things are going to matter. I think certainly, you know, what kind of birth control you have access to is going to influence how many kids you have, because your ability to control it is influenced by birth control. I think income is an important component of this. One of the most striking facts about fertility over the last several decades is that as many countries have gotten richer, fertility has gone down really dramatically, even in places that used to be very poor. And I think many people interpret that as an effect of income, that as you get richer, you want fewer children for various reasons. So I think that looks like a very strong driver of this effect.
Mm-hmm. You wrote a paper that I love about India and the introduction of TV in different areas in India, which allowed you to measure well the changes that TV brought. Can you talk about that in terms of fertility?
Yeah. So in that paper, we look at what happens when people get access to cable television. And we find something which actually has also been echoed in a study in Brazil, which is that when people get access to cable TV, which really lets them watch soap operas, it actually decreases their fertility. And one interpretation of that is that people see, you know, the people on TV, they have fewer kids and they have this really fancy life, presumably because they're on television. But, you know, maybe if I had fewer kids, I could have that also. And I think that's sort of one interpretation of that.
I guess another interpretation might be that soap operas are not as sexy as previously thought.
No, true. And also people are too busy watching TV to have sex is another interpretation we considered.
What do we know, if anything, about, I don't know quite what to call it, I guess mood or affect, you know, whether, let's say, someone who is optimistic about their own future, maybe their country's own future, is more or less likely to have children?
Yeah, I think the best evidence we have from that is about what happens in recessions, which is that fertility goes down. So even though broadly, as countries get richer over periods of decades. Fertility goes down as money goes up. In the short term, when we see a recession, we tend to see declines in fertility. And that sort of suggests that when people are less optimistic and, you know, maybe things are more complicated economically, that that's a time that people choose to delay.
Mm-hmm. But how can you tease out the economic optimism versus the economic reality? In other words, maybe I want to have kids right now, but I or a partner just lost a job or just got downgraded somehow. How do you tease out the mental effect?
That is a very hard thing to tease out. I think you can do it by looking at people who haven't lost their job. On the other hand, you know, those people may be more at risk of losing their job. So separating those things out is hard, and looking at people's affect by asking them, like, how do you feel about this and so on, is of course confounded by a lot of other things. You want to find something that changes people's mood about, say, their economic circumstances or something else without actually changing those circumstances. And that thought experiment is very hard.
So to me, one of the most interesting, if not necessarily broadly compelling arguments for the relationship between, let's say, you know, optimism and fertility is contained in a paper you wrote that's so fascinating. We talked to you about it earlier, about Huntington's disease and whether people who are genetically predisposed toward carrying it will want to get the test, and if they do or don't, how their lives may change or not change in light of that. So one surprising finding, at least surprising to me, was that people who know that they may be genetically predisposed to Huntington's disease aren't less likely to have kids. Yes? Why?
Yes.
Why is that? Why, in your view and from the data, do you believe that's true?
So I think our view when we looked at the data on this, and again, this is something where we can see the fact, but it's harder to see the interpretation. Our view is that people are not interested in facing the possible negative reality, and they would like to sort of take actions which make them feel like things are going to be okay. And if you want to have kids, you want to have kids. And that is, you know, something you're going to do anyway. And better to do it sooner so you're healthy for longer with these kids than you would be otherwise. And so I think that was our interpretation in that.
So if I'm an HD carrier, or I may be, and I don't know yet, there are two potential consequences to consider if I'm thinking about having kids. One is I, as a parent, may die relatively early, relatively young, and I, as a parent, may bequeath to my offspring this same genetic predisposition to this disease. Do you have any idea how those two potentialities are weighed in the minds of people with HD?
I think we don't, although, you know, from some anecdotal stuff, I think one of the pictures you get is that many people are optimistic, and I think we can all be hopeful about this, that there may be a better treatment or a cure for Huntington's disease in the future. And when you think about a disease like this, which has onset in adulthood, like at the 40s or 50s, and you think about having a child now, it's easy to imagine that maybe something will be different about treatment or cures later on. And so I think the sort of feeling of salience about passing on the gene is perhaps less strong than it would be if it were something which you knew would manifest right away, like Tay-Sachs.
Yeah. It strikes me as we're talking about this that optimism or pessimism are almost impossible really to measure, aren't they? I mean, you can ask people, but that doesn't really get you very far, does it?
Yeah, I agree. I don't think it gets you very far. And I think people will tell you things which are not right or are very person specific. I mean, my impression from some of the psychology of this is that, you know, people's level of optimism is pretty similar within a person, no matter what's going on. So, you know, if something really good happens, you're happy for like a few days, but, you know, then you go back to baseline. And sort of similarly, if something really bad happens, you're unhappy for a while, but you go back to baseline. And I think that's sort of something that that means it's hard. A lot of what you're going to pick up is sort of constant differences across people rather than changes over time that might affect their behavior.
Gotcha. Okay. So considering that, and considering everything that you, Emily, know about fertility and pregnancy and mortality, let's say that there's a terrible, terrible natural disaster that kills hundreds of thousands of people, including many, 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 many children who are very vulnerable to a natural disaster. What would you expect to happen in that kind of circumstance? That people would hurry to repopulate, or that they'd be so stricken that they'd not want to have kids?
It's an interesting question. I mean, it feels like a question for the data. I think both of those things would happen. My instinct based on what we know about fertility and high mortality environments, is that people would try to replace lost children. Because one of the explanations for why there's such high fertility in the developing world sort of, you know, many decades ago is that child mortality was so high, you want to have a lot of kids to replace the children that do not survive. And so an extension of that would be if you sort of lost a child or God forbid, children in a disaster, that you would want to have more children to replace them. But as you say, on the other side, there's sort of this terrible thing has happened and there's sort of incredible pessimism. And so that might affect fertility in the other direction.
But it's not like you can come up with an experiment to answer this question, right? It's not like you'd want to randomly kill 1,000 children in one state and not kill any children in the next door state and see what fertility looks like in those two states.
I agree. That does not sound like a great idea. And I think this is a hard thing to imagine testing for that reason.
Sometimes nature provides a tragedy that, on top of being a tragedy, is also an opportunity to answer this kind of question. In this case, it happened on December 26, 2004.
Good evening. The depths of the Indian Ocean have spawned a natural disaster enormous in scale.
The devastation. The most powerful earthquake in 40 years hit Asia overnight, the epicenter 40 miles off the coast of the northern Indonesian island of Sumatra, but it triggered massive tsunamis, tidal waves that spread.
Tsunami waves made no distinction between rich and poor, foreigners and locals. Children suffered particularly because they couldn't run away.
The tsunami killed more than 200,000 people, the vast majority of them in Indonesia.
One of the things that the tsunami did in terms of its impact on mortality was create large gaps in the population. Women were more vulnerable to being killed in the tsunami, and young children and older people as well. And so in the communities that were very badly damaged, you can actually see gaps in the age structure and the sex composition of the population.
That's Elizabeth Frankenberg.
I'm a demographer and a sociologist at Duke University. I teach in the Sanford School of Public Policy. And for the past 20 years or so, I've been studying various facets of demography and economics, particularly in Indonesia, but in developing countries. And most recently, my colleagues and I have been working on a project to understand how the tsunami that occurred in 2004 affected well-being, both in the short term and the longer term.
Frankenberg has been going to Indonesia for many years.
Well, the very beginning was way back in 1985. I was an undergraduate at the University of North Carolina. And I, you know, my dad was curious what I'd do when I graduated. And I said, well, I really want to work on issues in developing countries. And, you know, his advice, which was good advice, was, well, you probably ought to spend some time in one first before you commit too much to that. And I really love Indonesia. I love traveling there. I've made probably one trip a year or so. In many years, two or three or four trips. So I've gone a lot. I go regularly. I have great colleagues there. You know, a lot of my work is with Duncan Thomas, an economist here at Duke. We worked with our
colleagues. Now, you ended up marrying him a little bit, didn't you?
I did marry him. 100% married.
After the tsunami, Frankenberg and her colleagues had a specific set of issues to explore.
Well, we wanted to look at two questions, really. What happens to women's fertility in the aftermath of a shock of this nature that has several different components to it? One is mortality, mortality in communities, but also mortality within families. Another is the trauma that people were exposed to as a result of what had happened, because, you know, the people that survived, many of them were caught up in the water or experienced other traumatic experiences. And comparing at an aggregate level, fertility for women from two different types of communities, communities where the mortality impact had been very large relative to communities that had no tsunami mortality, and then within those communities, fertility of women who had lost a child relative to fertility of women who had not lost any children.
So what'd you find?
So we found a couple of things. One is that if you start from the perspective of communities, We compared fertility before the tsunami in communities that would later be strongly affected by tsunami mortality to fertility before the tsunami in communities that did not later experience these high death rates. And before the tsunami, fertility was a little bit lower in the communities that would later experience such high mortality.
Which we shouldn't draw any conclusion from. That's just random, I assume.
Well, yes. I mean, that's...
If not random, maybe is it a socioeconomic,
It's more, yeah, it's more of a socioeconomic thing.
Okay.
So then we look at what happened after the tsunami, and what we find is that fertility rose in the places that had very high levels of community mortality from the tsunami, but fell for women from communities that had not had high levels of tsunami mortality. And so they really respond in different ways with respect to fertility, and that introduces this gap. So we see this big fertility increase in the places where mortality from the tsunami was very high.
And can you just specify a little bit here, we're talking about mortality of any and everyone or mortality particularly of children?
We looked at it from both perspectives, but I've been talking about mortality of any and everyone. But the results are the same if you limit it to mortality of children.
Okay, so far the baseline, what you've established and told us, is that in the areas where the mortality from tsunami was higher, fertility rates went up.
Yes, exactly.
All right. Tell me more.
So then we also wanted to know for individual women whether their characteristics were linked to their fertility behaviors after the tsunami. And so demographers have long wondered about whether when women lose a child dies, whether they become pregnant again sort of to replace that child, effectively having a birth that would not have otherwise occurred. So we looked at whether losing a child in the tsunami predicted a birth after the tsunami. And the answer to that question was yes. Women who had lost a child in the tsunami were about 10 percentage points more likely to have another birth after the tsunami than women whose children had survived.
10 percentage points. And how many percent would that be? I assume that's quite a big rise.
Yeah, that was about a 37% increase.
Wow. And did that surprise you or no?
I would say that it did not. We didn't know what we would find, but, you know, we thought that it could have perhaps gone either way. I mean, perhaps women would be stressed and sad and grieving and not ready to do this again. But, you know, it might also be natural to have another child. So we thought it could go either way. So I would not say I was surprised by the finding, but I didn't have a strong prior that it would turn out that way. So that was one piece of it, was that women who had lost a child to death in the tsunami were considerably more likely to have a baby again after the tsunami. And then the other question was whether women who had not yet had children after the tsunami had children. And what we find then is that as the mortality rate rises in the community, women who had not yet had children were more likely to become mothers. So there's an interaction between the amount of mortality in the community and women having their first birth.
That's a timing question, meaning that woman A in province A where there was high mortality is going to have a first birth sooner than a woman in province B where there was low mortality, or would have more children over time, or do you not know that yet?
That's a great question. We don't know that yet. What we know, well, we know that they had the children earlier than would have otherwise been the case. But whether they will ultimately go on to have more is a question we can only answer when we have data from later waves. And we have a 10-year survey in the field right now, and that will help us answer that question. But that's absolutely an important question to know the answer to that we don't know yet.
Right. So let me ask you the most obvious and maybe the hardest question, and maybe there's no answer for this, or maybe you don't have the answer for this, but why? So if you observed a strong boost in fertility among communities where there was a lot of death from the tsunami, and you make a point of noting that there are two kinds, there's women who lost children who are, quote, replacing, and women who haven't yet had children who are having them sooner. Is there anything you can say about the why other than typical human speculation?
So some of it's speculation and some of it we know a little bit about. And so we did ask people after the tsunami whether they wanted to have more children. And, you know, the women we observe having more children indeed articulated a desire to have children after the tsunami. So it certainly doesn't seem to have been an accidental result or a result of poor access to contraception.
Right. It could be that the tsunami wiped out all access to contraception. But then on the other hand, there's available mates too. How does that factor into it?
So marriage and childbearing are certainly tightly linked, but because so many more women were killed in the tsunami than men, more of the men in our study lost spouses than women lost spouses. So marriage is certainly a part of it, and it's, you know, part of that fertility increase is younger women marrying and going ahead and having children. You know, as to the why, so we do ask people whether they want more children. We don't ask them why they want more children. And, you know, then you start to be more speculative. But I have to say, as I've traveled in Indonesia and watched the recovery in Aceh unfold, you know, one of the things that strikes me about Aceh is it's a place with such a strong sense of identity, of ethnic identity as Acehnese. And so I do think that there was a tremendous will to rebuild. And that's, you know, part of that is rebuilding families and population, but it's also rebuilding homes and livelihoods and the province overall. And, you know, I think that's a really important theme of, you know, both the fertility results, but also in some of the other work we've done, recovery more generally.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, people don't have children today for the same reasons they used to.
You know, childhood used to be like, by the time you're six, you're up at 4:30 milking the cows. And now it's like, you know, I'm taking you to soccer practice at 14 different locations so you can, you know, get into the right college or whatever it is.
And one more thing. If you have about 150 hours with absolutely nothing to do, check out our back catalog of Freakonomics Radio podcasts on iTunes or at Freakonomics.com. And if you subscribe on iTunes or using another podcast app, you will always get the next episode automatically delivered in your sleep.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
So Elizabeth Frankenberg, a demographer and sociologist at Duke, found that women who lost children in the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami were much more likely to get pregnant again.
So I have to say, I guess one way to interpret this finding, one way that I guess sprang to my mind, at least for whatever that's worth, is that it's a very, I don't know about inspiring, but hopeful finding in that here's a terrible tragedy that affects a lot of people. And rather than swear off community and, you know, country and family, the opposite happened.
Yeah.
And I'm curious what you think may have driven this on a broader scale. Do you think religion plays a role? Do you think the regional or cultural attitudes play a role? In other words, if a tsunami hit, you know, the southeastern United States, do you have any idea whether the findings might be remotely similar or South America?
Well, let me come back to the southeast United States and South America. So I definitely think that the fertility response, I mean, I agree with you that there's a strong sort of signal about hope in seeing this impact, this fertility impact. And, you know, traveling to these villages and watching these new homes be built and go from empty to inhabited to places where families live and families with little kids live, and these kids are out there playing and helping their parents do various things. You know, it really does create this sense of renewal in a way that's very, very fundamental. So I think you're right about this sense of hope coming out of these results. And, you know, I suspect that religion is involved in it. Aceh is a very, very strongly religious place. And in addition, the Acehnese people are very proud and independent people. And so I think it's both, you know, faith in religion and also faith in identity in some sense. And I should say, in addition to the family rebuilding, there was all this rebuilding of housing and infrastructure and roads and schools. And, you know, that was a function both of Achani's perseverance, but also of an incredible outpouring of funding for a recovery effort from all around the world, and a very strong effort by the Indonesian government to channel that money into effective reconstruction policies and assistance. And so I think, you know, an important backdrop of rebuilding families is the fact that assets were also getting replaced. People were working, those sorts of economic aspects of recovery as well.
Okay. And answer, if you feel like it, if you feel you have an answer to the second half of that very long question I asked about whether the same event, not a different event, but whether the same event had happened elsewhere in the world, if you have any knowledge at all into whether we'd see a similar effect.
Well, I do think that we would see this effect of fertility rise in places where children are killed suddenly and unexpectedly as a result of natural disasters. And so there has been a little work on other earthquakes that shows something similar, for example, in Iran. And then when the China earthquake hit in 2008, I guess, you know, schools were very, very badly damaged and many children were killed. And many of those children were only children. And Chinese government actually put in place a policy to try to help people who wanted to have an additional child at that point get access to reproductive, assisted reproductive technology if they wanted to try to have children again. So I don't think this fertility response is unique to Aceh or to Indonesia.
So we've learned that fertility tends to rise after a natural disaster, which might easily be interpreted as purely good news, as a triumph of the human spirit. On the other hand, what about overpopulation? For much of the past century, one of humankind's most pressing fears is that we're putting way too many people on the planet. Now, among population scholars, there's a famous saying, development is the best contraceptive. That is, as countries get richer, their population growth tends to slow. I asked the economist Emily Oster how well this saying is supported by the data.
I think the data suggests that's very true. So some of the changes in fertility over time in countries that are relatively poor have been incredibly striking. So for example, in the 1960s, India's fertility rate was at 6. It is now at 2.5. In that period, Singapore's fertility rate was 5.6. It's now at 1.3, which is far, far below replacement. And even in Kenya, which isn't like a particularly rich country, the fertility rate now is about 4.4, down from 8 or 9 in the 1960s. And those changes have been achieved. Yes, there has been some increase in birth control access, which we don't want to dismiss, but I think it's pretty clear from the timing that the development effects are just incredibly, incredibly important in driving this.
So let me ask you this, Emily. If you and I went out and did a survey right now and we on the streets of New York, on the streets of Providence, and asked 100 people the following question, the world population today is X. What would you expect the world population by the turn of the next century to be in relationship to X? What do you think would be the median or the average response there?
Yeah, I think people would think the number is 2X or something, but I think the number is not 2X. I mean, there's actually increasingly few countries whose fertility rate is above replacement, and many countries where the fertility rate is substantially below replacement.
Mm-hmm. So keeping in mind how terrible most predictions are, how would you describe where we're heading globally in terms of population and how we got there and what it means?
One, the population is going to be much older. So for most of human history, the kind of population pyramid has been more people who are young, fewer people who are old. That's still going to be true kind of to some extent. You're not going to have the population primarily made up of people who are 120. But the balance between, say, 65-year-olds and 25-year-olds is going to be very different. And that's something that's going to, you know, drive a lot of policy and the way that demographics work. I think the other thing that's going to happen is, for a while at least, relatively poor countries are going to continue to have fertility above replacement, while relatively rich countries do not. And that's going to change the balance of population counts across these places even more so than now.
So is that the driving factor in lower fertility rates is income? When you look at the countries with the lowest fertility rates around the world, is that what they primarily have in common?
When you start trying to distinguish among fertility rates, all of which are below replacement, the links with income become more mushy. So the places with the lowest fertility rates are like Singapore and Hong Kong and Taiwan. I mean, those are rich countries, but they're not as rich as, say, Finland.
Right. But there are other parts of Asia where the fertility rate is still relatively low, way, way, way lower than similarly poor parts of Africa, let's say, right?
Yes, I agree. So, you know, income sort of operates in like the places with the highest fertility are very poor, Niger, Mali. But the income fertility relationship does seem to break down a little bit when you get into the very low fertility rates. The U.S. has higher fertility than, say, most of Europe, even though the U.S. is relatively richer.
Mm-hmm. That said, fertility is falling pretty much everywhere around the world, correct? I mean,
yes.
Pretty much. So why have we seen such sharp declines in fertility, even in so many developing countries, where kind of the promise of the economic future isn't there yet?
I think the promise of the economic future is there more than we think. I mean, even places which are very poor, where things do not seem to be going that great, I think if you look sort of broadly since in the last 50 years, actually, the economic climate has improved. The health climate has improved. One of the reasons to have fewer kids is because fewer of them die in childhood. Once we start vaccinating people, which we're actually getting very good at, even in poor places, then you don't need to have as many kids to achieve the number you want to end up with. That's something called the demographic transition, which I think has sort of started happening basically everywhere. So I do think actually many, many, many places in the world, things are getting better, not worse.
You know, when people listen to economists, they hear two things that, to me at least, sound contradictory. One is, if you don't have enough people being born in a given place, you're in economic trouble because there won't be enough young workers to shore up the economy and the older retiring workers and so on. But you also hear, if you have too many people born in a given place, you know, there won't be enough jobs and funds for all those people and everyone in that place will suffer. So tell me, Emily, are these two arguments as contradictory as they seem to me? And if not, or maybe even if so, is there some perfect magic fertility rate that makes an economy hum?
It's 2.2. No.
Okay, see you later. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks very much. I think these are, both of these things are true. They are true for different reasons. It is true that if you have a very old population, there are not as many people to support them. It's not that you couldn't design policies that would allow that to work fine. It's just that the current policies most places have in place are not designed for that. So if you think about Social Security, it relies on people paying in so it can pay out. If you don't have enough people paying in, you're going to struggle to pay out. You could design a different system where people pay in and they get out what they put in. That would be sustainable no matter what your fertility rate is. It just isn't the system we have set up now. On the other side, on the sort of population growth side, I think it is true that as places grow very quickly in terms of population, that can be problematic for finding jobs. But again, it's a question of how you set up the incentives. And that can also be good for places because they get a lot of new workers and new people to do stuff. And that is an important aspect of economic growth as well.
So tell me if the following statements are true. You, Emily Oster, along with your husband, Jesse Shapiro, who's also an economist, currently have one child named Penelope, who's roughly 3 years old.
Yeah, she's 3 and a half.
Okay. Furthermore, you, Emily Oster, presumably along with your husband, Jesse Shapiro, once more are expecting a second child.
Yes, we are.
Okay. So in summary, why? Why are you having a second kid?
Well, the first one is so great. Having a kid is like the greatest thing that ever happened. And I think, we would like her to have a sibling. And so we're going to see how that goes.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, we talked to Charlie Rose and some other masters of the interview about one of the most common responses they get to just about any question.
Well, that's a good question.
That's a very good question.
That's a very good question.
And please take advantage of our free weekly Freakonomics Radio podcast, which you can find at Freakonomics.com, on iTunes, or any other podcast delivery system. Thanks.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
We've been doing the show for a while now, and I've noticed a trend.
Yeah, that's a great question.
So that's a good question.
That's a very good question.
So, it's a great question.
Look, I'm going to be honest with you. Most of the questions we ask, they aren't really all that great. But it's like there's a verbal tick going around.
Well, you know, that's another good question.
That's a really good question.
Good question.
Great question.
Great question.
Good question.
So those are good questions. Good way to sort it out.
And you know who has this tick really bad?
You know, that's a great question.
Yeah, Steve Levitt. You know who Steve Levitt is, don't you?
So that's a great question.
Levitt's my Freakonomics friend and co-author. He's an economist at the University of Chicago. Levitt, you've been at Chicago for quite a while now, haven't you?
That's a good question.
And you seem to think that when it comes to what makes a good question, absolutely no topic is off limits, wouldn't you say?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, it is true that people like their cows to have gotten to walk around a lot and eat fresh grass.
So, Levitt, do you have any recollection of saying that same phrase about 150 times? Is this something you know you're doing?
That's a good question.
I've heard it over and over for years, not just on our show. You hear it in all kinds of media interviews, during the Q&A portion of tech conferences and academic conferences. But just because I've heard it a lot, that doesn't mean much. We needed professional help.
My name is Erica Okrent. I'm a linguist, and I write for Mental Floss and The Week.
Okrent knows several languages.
I speak about six at a faking it level. So I can go for a while and have you convinced until you bring up something I've never talked about before, and then it all falls apart.
For the purpose of this discussion, we're sticking to English, and the phrase we're discussing today, that's a great question.
I started looking into it. Has it really been on the rise?
Okay, so how do you figure this out?
It's kind of hard to measure that because it's hard to find a corpus of data that will show spoken language over time that way. You can't look for it in Google Books or something because people don't normally write this phrase.
But Okrent was able to find a couple big collections of spoken language data.
One of them is the British National Corpus.
That's a 100 million word database, which includes transcripts of everyday conversation, as well as government meetings, media interviews, and so on.
And I did a search on the phrase there, and it only showed up 35 times in, you know, a corpus of like 100 million words. And a lot of those instances were fiction, so it wasn't too common over there. And then I took a look at the corpus of contemporary American English, and there it was over 1,000 times. And most of the instances were interviews on CNN or NPR or different one-on-one interview situations where there was an expert being interviewed about something. So it definitely seems to be more of an American thing.
In the House and the Senate, they both say they want to pass a bill by next week. The big question, what happens if they don't?
Well, that's a good question.
Does this bump hold up, do you think?
Well, that's a good question.
That's a very good question.
That's a very good question.
Well, you know, it's a good question.
Why has that not been enough to get him off death row in Texas?
This is a really good question.
Okay, and where does Erica Okrent think this habit has come from?
In looking around for it, I found that it's actually an explicit part of media and PR training.
I think it's still on the rise.
That's Bill McGowan. He does media and PR training for CEOs, athletes, artists, even the best men at weddings. His company is called Clarity Media Group, and he wrote a book called Pitch Perfect, How to Say It Right the First Time, Every Time. McGowan says that some people say, that's a great question, to serve as what's called a bridge.
The bridge is what happens when the person interviewing you or asking you questions wants to go down one conversational road.
You use it as a way to go from a potentially dangerous question back to your talking points, back to the point you want to make.
You don't know anything about what lies in that road, or you don't want to talk about that subject, you have a different conversational road you want to go down. So you need a bridge to get from one road to the other.
That's a good question is one of the phrases that allow you to do that. You get the question, you say that's a good question, it buys you a little time, and then you just jump right in with the point you wanted to make. And often people don't notice that you haven't dealt with the question or responded to the question.
Yeah, that's a really good question is the most elementary bridge possible.
Now, when Bill McGowan says it's elementary, he means really elementary.
I did a training for a nonprofit organization, and I had to role play as the interviewer with five or six of them. And there was one gentleman who sat in the chair, and he started every single answer with, "That's a really good question," even when I asked him, "So how long have you been with this organization?" "You know, Bill, that's a really good question." And I had to stop him and say, "No, that's actually not a good question. That's a really terrible question. It's just a conversation starter." And he saw the absurdity of starting his answer with that.
It was absurd because it had become such a habit that it lost its meaning. Nearly all of us have some kind of linguistic tic, some go-to phrase we probably don't even know we use. I, for instance, begin way too many sentences with "so," as in, "So what have we learned so far?" Or, "So what McGowan is really saying here?" Or, "So even President Obama uses a verbal bridge."
He has two words he uses that accomplish the same thing. One of them is, "Look."
"Well, look, you know, I think, Bill, the nature of being president is that you're always..."
And the "look" means he's trying to convey it as, "Let me be frank with you." Or the other word he uses is...
"Listen, as I think some of you saw when I was out..."
"Listen."
"The campaign trail..."
And whenever you hear "look" or "listen" come out of the president's mouth, that means he is no longer answering your question, he is answering his question.
But "look" and "listen" are not the only bridges used by President Obama.
"Well, Catherine, this is a great question. And, you know, I was raised by..."
So what exactly is "saying that's a great question" meant to accomplish?
I think people do it because they think it accomplishes two things simultaneously. It allows them to stall for time, and it flatters the interviewer.
It's for keeping the good vibes going. We're friends here. You're asking good questions. I'm giving good answers. You keep the good feeling going. And things like "that's a good question," "look," "the point is," "what I'm saying is," all of these phrases they're meta discourse phrases. They don't have to do with the content of the discussion or the things that you're talking about. They're about the discussion itself. And what they do is lay out a map or a path for the people listening to the discussion or the people involved in the discussion. So you say, "Ah, yes, the argument is, the point is," and you can do that, lay out these little pebbles when the discussion actually isn't going that way, but you give the illusion that this is what's happening.
In other words, as Erica Okrent sees things, it's linguistic BS.
Any phrase like that, they start somewhere and then people pick up on it. People start using it sincerely. And if it works well, it starts to become a crutch or a tick. And then people start to notice it and they start to hate it and complain about it.
I believe that saying "that's a really good question" is about as outdated a tick or a strategy as telling people to envision the audience in their underwear.
But some people do still use the phrase strategically. Andy Kessler is a former hedge fund manager who now writes about entrepreneurship. In a Wall Street Journal column, Kessler wrote about a trick that he admires. It's used by Silicon Valley entrepreneurs at board meetings. When an investor or outside board member asks a stupid question, Kessler writes, the CEO says, "That's a great question," and then gives the questioner an action item, something like, "Okay, can you survey the competition and report back on their capital plans and hiring ratios? Great, let's keep going." Eventually, Kessler writes, the stupid questions dry up, and people who ask them may stop coming to the meetings. Okay, so you can use the phrase as a form of retribution. Steve Levitt sees another use.
I like to try to, in everything in life, try to reward the people around me and acknowledge when they say funny things or smart things or they look good or, you know, act kind or things like that. So as a general rule, I've adopted, especially as I've gotten older, to try to do really nice things to people as much as I can, especially if they're very low cost to me. I like to do nice things that don't cost me anything but are good to other people. And so I think that's one very strong piece of saying it's a great question is really just acknowledgement that someone who's sort of in the background is actually doing something that's cool or interesting or challenging.
When Levitt and I published Think Like a Freak, we went on a long book tour, first in the US and the UK. The whole time, it was back-to-back-to-back-to-back interviews and Q&A sessions.
We get interviewed so much, so when we hear something new, something we haven't thought about, it's just, it's fun. I mean, because it's actually somewhat fun to be interviewed and to answer questions. Being interviewed can range from incredibly dull and boring to really, really fun. And I think of just our own experiences. So somehow, the times when we've gone on the Charlie Rose Show, I have been completely stunned because the way he asks questions and what he says end up being super interesting and fun and getting me to say things I never would have said to anyone else.
Hey, Charlie.
Hey, Stephen. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Good.
That, of course, is Charlie Rose. I'm curious, who have you interviewed so far today, Charlie?
I interviewed John McCain and John Dickerson. And then last night, I interviewed Dan von Furstenberg, who's going to be on the show at 11 o'clock tonight.
Charlie Rose is the dean of the television interview. In the AM, he can be found at CBS This Morning, along with Gail King and Nora O'Donnell. At night, the show is simply called Charlie Rose. He has interviewed more people, especially more smart people, than anyone I know of. How do you take it when someone says, let's say you're sitting down with, you know, maybe it was Steve Jobs, maybe it was President Clinton, and you ask a question, and they look at you across the table. I say, Charlie, you know, that's a great question.
I think they're trying to flatter me most of the time, or they believe it. I mean, whatever, whether it's egotistical, and I think it was a good question, and I agree with them, because I thought about it and structured it and gave some consideration to it. Or B, it's spontaneous and flattering. And less so, it's simply buying time as they crystallize their thought.
It strikes me that you're someone who works hard to ask the kind of questions that people think are really good questions, that are really good questions.
I do. I mean, it would be clearly naive of me to say that I don't think about the craft of the question. I think about that a lot. How to ask the question, what I expect to get from the question. And so how the question is perceived makes a difference to me. I structure the question hoping to get the best possible response. I used to make longer questions with some assumption that I had to explain the question. I spend more time now simplifying the question.
Take us a little further into that. When you say that you structure the question hoping to get the best possible response, I guess what I want to know from you is, how do you know what the best possible response is? In other words, are you trying to, like a prosecutor, get the answer to a question that you sort of know already?
Well, let me do something first. I would be tempted to say that's a very good question that you just asked me. But because of this conversation, I'm not going to say that.
Okay, cheers.
But I would say that because that is the right question. It's not for me that I want them to say something that I think they've said before and I want them to repeat it. So I'm not asking questions to have someone tell me what I want them to say or to tell me something that they've already said before. What I want them to do is surprise me with an answer, to go deeper, wider, more interesting than they have before. And there is a kind of moment in which you try to say something that is that just captures the moment and makes the person be caught up in the question rather than simply, you know, repeating something that they've said 1,000 times before.
You know, it strikes me hearing you talk, I care a lot because I do interviews.
Right.
I do sort of what you do, but for most people listening to this, you know, there are going to be a million people or so who hear you talking about this, and they don't do interviews typically. But I wonder, Charlie, if you think what you're describing in how you think about a question can be generalizable for any person in not doing an interview per se, but just having a conversation with another person, whether it's a friend, family member, or stranger.
I do think that, and I encourage that. I encourage it at a couple of levels. One, just in normal conversation. I mean, be genuinely curious. You don't have to make a conversation serious, but make it in the moment. But let your curiosity inspire you, and that will help. The other thing that happens to me is that, you know, there's an interesting thing. People come to my table expecting to talk about themselves, their work, their relationships, their hopes for the future, their experience. They come expecting that. Most of the time, you know, in regular conversation, that's not what happens. So sometimes people will come to me and say, gee, you know, you ask my friend questions that I could never ask them, you know, because they expect you to ask them. That's who you are. And my point to them is, no, you should ask them. You should engage in conversations that have to do with something, not all the time. It should often be simply, you know, reacting to the moment of the moment that we all do, whether it's sports or entertainment or relationships. But there are those profound questions that I think all of us would be better off if we occasionally dived into.
Charlie, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Let me be clear on one thing. When it comes to saying, that's a great question, perhaps saying it disingenuously, I myself am not innocent. When I'm on the other side of the microphone than I am now, I am a menace.
Yeah, that's a great question. So
yeah,
that's a good question. So that's one of the.
Yeah, that's a great question. That's a really, really good and really hard question.
And I know where I caught it. I caught it from Steve Levitt.
Maybe I invented it. Maybe I'm the inventor of that's a great question.
I remember when I first heard you say it, you were giving an academic talk, I think, at University of Chicago. You were discussing research of yours. And in an academic setting, especially when someone challenges either methodology or finding or data or whatever, I guess I expected that the first response would always be to just shout it down immediately and show why, no, I've already thought this through and here's why you're wrong and here's why I'm right. But I remember you just saying, you know, that's a really good question, and something to the effect of like, I wish I'd thought of that while doing my research, because, you know, it might be right, it might be wrong, but it certainly would have broadened my thinking on this. So that, I remember, is where I first heard it from you.
I'm sure I stole it from somebody, but I can't pin my finger on who that particular genius would have been.
Mm. All right. Well, Levitt, I feel indebted to you because I feel it's, you know, if not valuable, then at least useful. And I use it now and again. And so I kind of would like to return the favor to give you something that you can use in certain circumstances. So here's the thing. Do you ever... you ever have a circumstance where you're interacting with someone, maybe kind of in passing, and they say something to you and you don't quite catch it, or they say something to you that you don't want to have heard, but you kind of need to say something? Do you ever have that at all?
You're leaving the room? Yeah, all the time.
All right.
All the time.
So here's what you say. You ready? You might want to write it down. Yep. You say, Rebus Acasafram. Let me hear you say that.
Rebus Acasafram?
Like, more like one word. Rebus Acasafram.
Rebus Acasafram.
Good, right. So that is a phrase that was invented by some genius. I don't know who. I do know where I learned to say this was from the former dean of students at Dartmouth. And he was always getting these conversations in passing where you had to have the response, but you had no idea what the person was talking about. They might have been talking about a relative of yours or a former encounter. Like, I can see you using this a lot. And you want to say something on your way out. You don't want to be rude, but you have no idea what the response is. If you say Rebus Acasafram, the human
human ear will interpret that in one of 100 different ways, and they will almost certainly think that you actually said something real when you didn't. So
that's great. I love that.
You're welcome.
I love that. Rebus Acasifram.
Thanks for listening today. You can find all our Freakonomics Radio podcasts at Freakonomics.com or on iTunes. You can also reach us at radio@Freakonomics.com, and you can find us on Twitter and Facebook. Talk to you next week.